ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, as the Iran war disrupts supply, the Prime Minister meets with the Sultan of Brunei to try and secure more fuel and fertiliser. Also, Australia's richest person, Gina Rinehart, has mixed fortunes at the end of one of the nation's longest-running legal battles. And could an electric fin on a surfboard help repel sharks?
We want to use proven technology to incorporate into fins that creates an electric field around the fins and the surface and the surfboard.
First this evening to the latest on the conflict in the Middle East. The American President Donald Trump says peace talks between the US and Iran could resume in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad in a matter of days. And it appears Israel and Lebanon may be making progress in their discussions to end the fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed, Lebanon-based militant group Hezbollah. After a meeting in Washington with the US Secretary of State, they've now agreed to direct negotiations. It's a diplomatic breakthrough for those two countries, but Hezbollah is continuing to ignore those talks and fire rockets into Israel. This report from Rachel Hayter starts in Iran.
At the halfway point in a precarious two-week ceasefire between the United States and Iran, this Tehran woman, whose identity we're protecting, describes the Iranian regime as a wounded wolf.
People are more worried after the ceasefire because we think they've left us with a wounded wolf.
She believes the United States has backed away from the idea of regime change, which makes her depressed.
The US has given the Islamic regime some time, and what are they using this time for? They're using it for executing its own people.
This Tehran woman says security forces continue to monitor the population and try to control the flow of information out of the country.
Every night, government is sending its people. It's not just military. People like morality police, they come out and they are saying that the government is going to win, something like that. And whenever people, even from inside their houses, from the window, the balcony, they decide to take a video, it's not safe because they're sending lights with a laser from in street.
The current ceasefire ends in a week, on Wednesday, the 22nd of April. And the US President Donald Trump says peace talks could start again in the next 2 days. Vice President J.D. Vance says Donald Trump wants not a small deal, but a grand bargain.
The reason why the deal is not yet done is because the president, he really wants a deal where Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon, Iran is not state sponsoring terrorism, but also the people of Iran can thrive and prosper and join the world economy.
This war has cost Iran an estimated $270 billion in losses, according to Iranian state television, citing a government spokesperson. That's about $380 billion Australian dollars. After the first round of negotiations, the US imposed a naval blockade on Iran, preventing ships from entering or leaving its ports. US Central Command Chief Admiral Brad Cooper said in a statement, the blockade is going well and involves more than 10,000 US sailors, marines and airmen, more than a dozen warships and dozens of aircraft.
In less than 36 hours since the blockade was implemented, US forces have completely halted economic trade going into and out of Iran by sea.
Meanwhile, talks between Israel and Lebanon have been praised by all parties after an historic two-hour meeting in the US capital, Washington, D.C., and an agreement to continue direct talks. Lebanon's ambassador to the US, Nada Hamadeh Moawad, described the talks as constructive. Israel's ambassador to the US, Yekia Leiter, called them a victory for sanity, responsibility, and peace.
We are both united in liberating Lebanon from an occupation power dominated by Iran called Hezbollah. Lebanon is under their occupation, and we are suffering from their constant barrages of missiles and terror attacks.
Dr. Mariam Farida, a Hezbollah expert and lecturer in security studies at Macquarie University, suggests negotiations to disarm Hezbollah must involve their backer, Iran.
What will happen to the 250,000 fighters that belong to the party? And what will happen to the alliance or the support that Iran provides to this group?
Dr. Farida also argues that Lebanon's capacity to disarm Hezbollah is limited.
The Lebanese government is unfortunately a weak and fragile and a mostly corrupt government. The Lebanese army is a weak institution. Militarily, Hezbollah is the most powerful. Since November 2024, the Lebanese army and the government have stand and broadcasted a campaign that they will be disarming the group systematically. But this has not been successful, as we all know now.
Israeli forces are currently occupying parts of Lebanon's south. And in a statement, the Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun, said the only solution to the conflict is ensuring that Lebanese armed forces are solely responsible for the security of the area.
That report from Rachel Hayter and Annie Guest. As the Middle East conflict and the troubles in the Strait of Hormuz continue to threaten reliable supplies of fuel and fertiliser to Australia, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has today met with the Sultan of Brunei to discuss trade matters. Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter. Stephen, what commitments has the Prime Minister secured in Brunei?
Well, the Prime Minister and the Sultan of Brunei have signed a joint statement, which is pretty broad. Essentially, what it says is that the two countries are committed to open flows of energy, to protecting energy supply chains, and doing what they can to make sure those supply chains don't seize up, despite the enormous pressure, of course, being placed on them by the war in Iran and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Now, on top of that, Anthony Albanese said after the meeting that he'd secured certain, quote, guarantees from the Sultan and from the government of Brunei. On top of that list is a guarantee that they are, quote, according to Mr. Albanese, not looking at imposing export restrictions on Australia. Not only that, he said that the Sultan of Brunei and the government might be willing to go further and increase the amount of fertiliser they supply to Australia, potentially protecting it from a shortage which has been caused worldwide, or which could soon be caused worldwide, by oil shortages out of the Strait of Hormuz.
What's guaranteed is that they are not looking at imposing export restrictions on Australia. And as we go forward, of course, in today's uncertain world, there are pressures on all of the economies in the region. But what Australia has done is to not only did we speak about today about existing supplies coming, we spoke about additional supplies as well.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, speaking in Brunei. Stephen, how plausible is it, though, that Australia can ensure that there aren't any major disruptions to the flow of fuel or other essential goods from countries in Asia?
Look, I don't think anyone in the government, even those making the most heroic and optimistic assumptions, would argue that they'll be able to protect all of Australia's flows of energy if this war continues to drag on. Even if it ends now, as the government points out, the damage done to the essential infrastructure that allows the flow of energy from the region has been so badly damaged that this conflict will have a very long tail. I think what the government is hoping here is that when the inevitable shocks do start to move through these economic systems, including throughout the region, that Australia can be put at the front of the queue to ensure that they are as minimal as possible. And if there is a scramble for these essential supplies, that Australia at the very least gets its fair share. But in the end, if countries are facing an absolute shortage of raw oil coming in, they are inevitably going to prioritise their own needs first, and Australia is inevitably going to be facing a bit of a squeeze. Whether it can make up most of that shortfall through leaning on Southeast Asian partners or by sourcing alternative supplies, as we're already doing at the moment, of course, from the US and other parts of the world already, is what's up in the air at the moment. And all of that will depend on how long this supply shock lasts, how severe it is, and just how bad the shortfall gets.
So he's been in Singapore, now Brunei. Where's the Prime Minister off to next?
Well, the Prime Minister's off to Malaysia next, and he'll meet with Anwar Ibrahim, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, tomorrow, as well as sitting down with representatives of the Petronas company. That's a massive oil and gas company based in Malaysia. And Malaysia is also another very important supplier to Australia, in particular of refined fuels. So it will be interesting to see how those meetings go. The Prime Minister will be making a similar argument to Anwar Ibrahim that is made to both the Prime Minister of Singapore and to the Sultan of Brunei, namely that Australia is an essential provider of food and energy, and that the industries that produce those things that Southeast Asia needs relies on diesel, which they get from Southeast Asia. But Malaysia, a country that's already flagged that it may need to cut back on exports in order to prioritise its own citizens, may require a little bit more convincing than the other countries he's visited so far.
Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. Today marks 3 years since the start of the civil war in the African nation, Sudan. More than 40,000 people are believed to have been killed in the conflict between the Sudanese armed forces and the rebel group, the Rapid Support Forces. And more than 21 million people are experiencing acute hunger. The United Nations says it's the world's largest humanitarian crisis, yet aid agencies believe Sudan is being forgotten by the world. Kimberly Price prepared this report.
In the town of Tawila in Sudan's North Darfur region, Khadija is preparing a meal. The mother of eight is one of more than 600,000 people sheltering in makeshift homes of sticks, hay and plastic. Her family travelled more than 70 kilometres on foot from Al-Fasha after the rebel paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces seized the city last year. The United Nations say the Rapid Support Forces' actions in Al-Fasha amount to war crimes. Khadija says it was a perilous time.
We were in Al-Fasha when the war happened. The situation was terrible. You could either find food for children or they go without. No jobs are available.
The conflict erupted in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, after a power struggle between the Sudanese armed forces and the Rapid Support Forces in April 2023. Fighting has spread to nearly all parts of the country. Death toll estimates vary from 40,000 up to 400,000. Eva Hines is UNICEF's Chief of Advocacy in Port Sudan.
There definitely is a risk that the world has forgotten about the war in Sudan. And if we just look at the first 3 months of this year, at least 245 children were reportedly killed or injured, and this is a sharp increase if we compare to the same period last year.
As humanitarian groups try to get help to those most in need, Eva Hines says there's fears the situation could be made worse by the war in the Middle East.
We are seeing spikes in oil prices, and that means that it becomes more expensive to bring humanitarian aid into Sudan, as well as then move the aid trucks across the country. It is also likely that the fertilizer prices, that those will go up. So all of this, of course, has an impact on the situation that's already difficult when we talk about food insecurity, when we talk about hunger.
Carl Scow is the Deputy Executive Director of the World Food Programme.
3 years of war in Sudan have created the world's largest humanitarian crisis.
He says every month the World Food Programme reaches about 4 million people with food and nutritional support, but there are many more in need.
This assistance saves lives, it keeps families going, and it holds communities together. The needs are far greater than the money available.
Much of the world's humanitarian support relied on programs from the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. But under the Trump administration, the Foreign Aid Agency has been dramatically cut. Corey Alpert is a former Biden White House staffer and democracy researcher at the University of Melbourne.
We generally think they cut about 83-ish percent of funding and staffing resources. There was a study done in the year after they began cutting that found that several hundred thousand people just in that year had lost their lives because of preventable illnesses that resulted from this cut in USAID funding.
USAID's funding cuts were part of Elon Musk's reduction of federal spending. Corey Alpert says in a conflict like Sudan, the loss of USAID's famine early warning system has been a major blow to humanitarian efforts across the country.
This meant that the entire world could know where food aid needed to go, where specific resources needed to go. Think of the World Food Program has now lost essentially its primary diagnostic tool to know where to send their work. And without them, we are really leaving an entire country, an entire population at much greater risk.
After previous peace negotiations between Sudan's warring sides and the Quad coalition of the United States, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates and Egypt came to a standstill, world leaders will soon meet in Berlin to address the conflict.
Kimberly Price reporting. Australia's richest person, the mining magnate Gina Rinehart, has had mixed fortunes in the judgment in one of the nation's longest-running and most expensive court battles. A West Australian Supreme Court judge has ruled the earnings from a lucrative iron ore project in the state's Pilbara region must be shared with the family company of the late Peter Wright. He pioneered iron ore mining in the area with Mrs. Rinehart's father, Lang Hancock. Our reporter David Webber in Perth has more on the decision for us. David, take us back years ago. What's the basis of this dispute?
Well, the discoveries of iron ore in the Pilbara region by Gina Rinehart's father, Lang Hancock, and his school buddy, Peter Wright, who was a fellow prospector, I mean, that's laid the groundwork. What happened was the assets were divided into two lists by Lang Hancock and Peter Wright down the track because they decided to divide them up. And one area called East Angeles apparently wasn't in the list because the government at the time had decided that they couldn't be exploited. East Angeles, which is part of the Hope Downs assets. So essentially, this is an asset that was in dispute. And Wright Prospecting, because the idea was that any exploitation of any assets in that part of the world would benefit Wright Prospecting and Hancock Prospecting in terms of royalties. So the royalties issue is something that Wright Prospecting felt it had been dudded on, saying that they believed that they should have been paid royalties in the Hope Downs assets for some time now, but we're also seeking an ownership stake in Hope Downs assets. And the degrees are quite huge, but we're talking about the difference of hundreds of millions of dollars when it comes to royalties and billions of dollars when it comes to ownership of Hope Downs assets.
So David, who lined up against Gina Rinehart in this case and what did they argue?
So, of course, Lang Hancock and Peter Wright are both deceased. The Wright Prospecting Group is really the family company of Peter Wright, and they were seeking access to royalties that they claimed that they were owed from the Hope Downs assets. Gina Rinehart's Hancock Prospecting was on the other side. And John Hancock and Bianca Rinehart, the eldest kids of Gina Rinehart, had claimed via the courts that there was a claim in the Hope Downs assets was left to them in a trust by Lang Hancock. Now, there are several issues there because there's a trust dispute between the kids and Gina Rinehart that was tangentially related to this case.
So it's a very complex case, David. What did the judge actually rule?
So the judge ruled that Wright Prospecting was entitled to royalties from the Hope Downs assets, but not entitled to any ownership claim there. And that's significant because it's a difference of, as I might have mentioned earlier, a difference between hundreds of millions and billions of dollars, because if you own an asset, obviously it can keep producing profits and all that kind of stuff. So it's really a win for both sides.
So how have both sides of the case reacted to the judge's decision?
Well, they both welcomed the decision because Wright Prospecting says, we're happy with the royalties rulings. They're going to look at the judgment, very lengthy judgment, before deciding whether to proceed with any further steps. And that's code for future legal action. But also with Hancock Prospecting, very happy that they say that the decision has basically said that they are the rightful owners of the Hope Downs assets and that other parties don't have a claim in a stake in those assets.
David Weber reporting from Perth. And there was another party to the case, the company DFD Rhodes, which was founded by Lang Hancock and Peter Wright's one-time business partner, Don Rhodes. It also had a partial victory, with the judge ruling it deserved to receive some of the proceeds from Hope Downs. Well, if you're a surfer or an ocean swimmer, chances are you've thought about how to best protect yourself from sharks. There are plenty of shark deterrent products, from specialised wetsuits to electric and magnetic devices. Now a team of researchers in New South Wales is working on developing a surfboard fin embedded with shark deterrent technology. Bridget Fitzgerald has more.
Sean Murphy spends a lot of time in the water. The former journalist is an avid ocean swimmer and surfer, and while he tries not to think about sharks, he does take precautions.
You know, I don't swim when the water's too murky. I don't swim out wide anyway. Try and avoid swimming in the dark. I don't really like to surf on my own. I'd rather have company.
He also wears a popular shark deterrent product, a magnet band that fits around the wrist or ankle.
My swimming friends tease me that it's the world's most expensive fridge magnet, but it gives me some peace of mind.
Julian Taylor has owned a surf shop in Sydney's Mosman for more than 40 years. He estimates he's sold hundreds of thousands of shark deterrent devices, and they continue to sell out of them.
Obviously, when there's an attack, there's a lot of media around that. You know, that people start thinking about shark mitigation and shark deterrents.
Researchers found that a variety of sharks will react to magnetic devices, but only at quite close range, most effective at around 30 centimetres away. Devices that emit some kind of electric pulse appear to be the most effective kind of deterrent, which is why a group of researchers and manufacturers in New South Wales has launched a project to create a surfboard with the technology built in.
Probably the best equivalent is like a dog whistle. So we won't hear it, but the dog finds it annoying and goes away from the different sound.
Professor Mark Ennett-Ponise is the director of the Surf Flex Lab at the University of Wollongong. He's working in partnership with researchers at the University of New South Wales and a company called Gowings Brothers, which owns one of the world's leading surfboard fin manufacturers, FCS.
We want to use proven technology to incorporate into fins that creates an electric field around the fins and the surface and the surfboard that then disrupts the shark's electroreceptors.
The biggest hurdle, however, will be the weight and how to create a device that doesn't change the manoeuvrability of the surfboard. Professor Ennett-Ponise says a surfboard fin usually weighs between just 70 and 100 grams.
One of the challenges that we face is to include a system in the fins, also develop a power unit. And in addition to the electric fields, we also want to use illumination as a shark deterrent. That's also been proven that different combinations of light can also disturb the shark's behavior.
While shark deterrent technology has demonstrated some successes, users must be wary that there's no way to completely protect yourself in the water. Dr. Jody Rama is a professor of marine biology at James Cook University in Townsville.
Not all devices and not all shark species and not all situations are the same. So I think that's really important to point out from the start. But the strongest message that we're finding from the latest research is that some of these devices can reduce risk, but they're not a guarantee.
Dr. Rama says because sharks are extremely sensitive to electrical cues in the water, electroreception devices can overstimulate sharks and cause them to turn away. But reactions can differ between species and even individual sharks. She says any deterrent devices should be seen as just another layer of protection, but she supports research and development of any non-lethal mitigation technology.
As we keep improving the science that we're doing, we're going to help reduce the risk to people without defaulting to killing animals that are important to the health of our oceans and ecosystems. So if deterrents are going to help us do that, then they're absolutely worth investing and really carefully considering and doing the research so that we have that evidence base to make these decisions.
Dr. Jody Rummer from James Cook Uni in Townsville. That report from Bridget Fitzgerald and Mike Edwards. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning too. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. What does Trump's blockade in the Strait of Hormuz mean for our fuel supply? Well, it's not great. Today, Sol Kavanagh, energy expert at MST Financial, on why we're facing a doomsday scenario that's been wargamed for decades. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.